In this session, our first speaker is Dr. Brian Davey. Dr. Davey has a PhD in biology from Texas A&M, focusing on fisheries biology and natural resource management. He has worked as a postdoctoral fellow at Cornell University and as a visiting scientist at Tokyo University of Fisheries. He has mainly worked with IRDC for 35 years, based in Canada as well as in Singapore. He has been the executive secretary for the Strategy for International Fisheries Research, a multi-donor coordination body for enhanced fisheries research and development in the third world. His interests lie in the natural resource management with a focus on aquatic resources, especially aquaculture within these management systems. Ladies and gentlemen, join me in welcoming Dr. David to this and to give his presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Jacob. I'm very happy to see so many faces here on a Friday afternoon. That's a good sign, and I hope we can keep things interesting for you. You will see the membership of our panel on the screen. Just to say a little bit about the approach that we've tried to follow. You've just heard Gary Jensen's comments, which included, by the way, a nice reference to our book, which I assure you we didn't do any paying him to do that, but it was nice to see him have a photograph of our book. I hope you noticed that, everybody. In terms of our panel, we have set up our study to try and take some of the concepts that Gary talked about in terms of this very broad topic of research, communications, training, and extension. And what we've tried to do is to focus it down through six case studies that have been prepared by the individuals that are listed along past my name and Doris Soto's name. All of this has been done with the able guidance of Doris, whom I think you know, and she will, with the others listed up there, come in the end of the presentation by me and sit here and try to answer questions, etc. So the format will try to follow the same structure that we have done on the other panel discussions. I am presenting material that is based on the work of the whole panel, and our study and particularly the approach that we adopted is a little bit different than some of the others. What we decided to do was to actually put together six case studies. So I will summarize these six case studies, and that will give you a very rough initial flavor of some of our thinking around the core set of issues that we decided to focus on, which we are calling knowledge and communications. So we've taken this rather broad title and tried to take some of the ideas mentioned by Gary and focus through these six cases on particularly the knowledge and communications aspect of this work. So I will briefly summarize the cases. There are full papers of these cases that will be available in the publication. Then I will try to capture some lessons learned and then go on to look at what are some of the key issues that we think might be useful to follow up as part of a strategy that might follow from this panel and this meeting. So I will try and do all that in 30 minutes, and then the panelists will join me at the front here, and we will try to take questions. And particularly, I'm hoping that you will try to involve my colleagues from the panel in terms of some of this discussion process. Okay. In terms of our approach, as I say, what we've tried to do is focus on knowledge and communications. And I think we all know, historically, knowledge has been very important throughout the history of aquaculture, whether we're talking the earliest aquaculture in China, the story of Fan Li mentioned earlier, early work in Egypt, etc. But particularly sometime around the 60s and 70s, there was a period where research, and particularly what I'm calling, in quotes, good science, started to play a much more important role. Research on breeding of some of the key species, developing diets, doing some of the disease treatment, etc. And particularly some of this disease aspect, as you've heard in the sessions earlier today, yesterday, etc., has become a more important challenge. So there's a whole set of critically important knowledge issues around this that we are looking to explore. The other general comment I want to make is that there have been very few studies that have actually looked at aquaculture through a knowledge lens. Yet there are a lot of other sectors. We heard mentioned earlier the knowledge economy thinking in business, a lot of the health research that I'm going to draw on in some of the lessons learned at the end of this presentation, where I think there are very useful models or at least things for us to think about in terms of how we might approach something looking at aquaculture through a knowledge lens. Also, I want to draw on the ICT, the information communications technology people. They have work around this knowledge for development, abbreviated as K4D. So this is some of the material that we would like to try and look at and try to see how this might fit in with some kind of present as well as follow-up work around this set of issues. One of the things that the conference organizers asked us to do was to look a little bit at the history of these past meetings. A number of us, not that many actually, were in Kyoto in 1976. I gather there are seven or eight dinosaurs, myself included, that were at that meeting. And at that meeting, knowledge sharing and networking were highlighted. In Bangkok, there were these three items that we've listed here that were indicated as part of the Bangkok Declaration. Investing in people through education and training, investing in R&D, and improving information flow and communications. Most of these were at a very general level, I would say, and not really coming to some of the issues that we would like to see in what follows. So partly what we're hoping to get you thinking about, commenting on when we have the panel discussion, is in terms of this, the BKD, the Bangkok Declaration, how we might revisit some of that thinking, and particularly how that might be translated into some of the issues that will go into this Phuket consensus document that Jian-san has explained to us earlier. Okay, what do we mean by knowledge? Well, the Oxford Dictionary talks in terms of knowledge as expertise, skills, familiarity gained by experience, or education and education. So there's something around that set of issues that we're thinking in terms of what is knowledge. And then what is knowledge management? It's, in our terms, this range of strategies, practices, an issue that I will come back to in some of this, particularly used in terms of identification, creating, representation, etc., of these insights and experiences. What we also thought would be useful was to lay out a couple of concepts. And there's an evolving literature, not in aquaculture, but from other thinkers in terms of knowledge and how we might think about it. I was particularly attracted to this one by George Siemens on connectivism, where he says, our ability to learn what we need for tomorrow is more important than what we know today. In his terms, he says that the knowledge pipe, the pipe itself is more important. That is, this connection is more important than the knowledge itself. A point we'll come back to. The other one, just to be stimulating thinking along these lines, is that experience has long been considered the best teacher of knowledge. Since we cannot experience everything, other people's experience therefore other people, become the surrogate for knowledge. I store my knowledge in my friends. So although this may be a little bit axiomatic, I think there is a kernel of truth, and one that will, I think, come through in some of the cases that we're talking about. Another concept that I wanted to put on the table is what some call moving from outputs to outcomes and impacts. And that if we think in terms of knowledge and results chains, there is a whole set of issues in terms of not just producing papers, not just producing these outputs of reports or what have you, but thinking more in terms of outcomes and impacts, where you actually are trying to change people's behavior. And I think some of this thinking goes to the core of some of the sustainability issues that we've been talking about, and that's part of what we would like to see more discussion on. Questions around what knowledge? Knowledge for whom? Knowledge from whom? Again, this connectivity thinking. And as Gary mentioned, there is a whole body of knowledge coming from other groups around what some call knowledge translation. Some of the questions to Gary's presentation raised the issue of barriers and interfaces in terms of trying to get some of this knowledge translated into something implementable. And we'll come back to that. And Sena Da Silva and I have talked a lot about this, and we are going to introduce you to a new term we're calling aquaphase thinking. I'll come back to that too. Okay, what we tried to do was to get some kind of measure, very, very rough, so don't jump on this too hard, but some kind of measure of the supply of knowledge. So what kinds of research, what kinds of knowledge can we say is out there? So I found this reference to 42, and again I put in quotes, aquaculture journals. The list is found at this website. But more importantly, this study by Jörg Roos and Laurie in 2006 estimated that there are 24,000 science journals. And this is not just natural science, this is social science as well. And that roughly, and again this is 2006 data, there's more than 1 million articles, 1.35 million published annually. And probably it's closer to 2 million now. And that these numbers are growing very exponentially, and that there are implications to that in terms of what some of these knowledge theorists talk about in terms of knowledge half-life. And that particularly given this rapid exponential growth of knowledge, we're looking at knowledge going out of usefulness in shorter and shorter periods. And some people suggest that what was known 10 years ago, only half or less is of value at present. So again, there's a variety of issues there, not to debate the details in terms of exactly how many articles or how many journals or what the half-life is, but I think there are solid issues there that we need to think about in terms of what we're trying to do in these conferences, how useful it is thinking back 10 years, given the fact that if this half-life information thinking is correct, a lot of that is not that useful. Anyway, that's some of the supply side, particularly from the researcher level. As we all know, there are a variety of types of knowledge, but very little data, particularly in aquaculture. We could find little solid information in terms of farmer-based knowledge and other stakeholder-type knowledge. And so I think there's a whole set of issues about where knowledge is produced, by whom, what type of knowledge, etc. This is a photo from Doris on shrimp farmers and the kind of knowledge they have in terms of temperature, disease relations, etc. Another conceptual issue, in terms of knowledge sharing, we see in our cases and in some of the literature that, again, we're at a very early stage in terms of knowledge sharing processes and understanding them. And particularly, we see that there are increasing numbers of stakeholders in aquaculture. At least that is my impression, and I think there is some shared view on that. But I see little data looking at what numbers of stakeholders are we talking about? Who are these stakeholders, and how are they changing over time? And then particularly, how are we meeting their knowledge needs? And I think when we talk about aquaculture, we're talking about change, and we're talking about stakeholders who are increasing in numbers, but many of whom come in with very limited exposure to some of the issues. And I think that's part of our problem. That's part of our challenge, I should say, in terms of trying to promote sustainability, for instance. Not everybody has the same knowledge base, and there's a whole set of issues there that I think we need to better understand. And that's one of the threads that pervades some of our thinking. Finally, a number of the groups, including many of you here, have been looking at some of this shared learning around, for instance, the better management practices and other knowledge processes. And I highlight that as one of the sort of current knowledge issues that is being increasingly looked at. Okay, our cases. So we have six cases. The first one is looking at the story you've heard already of the catfish in Vietnam. Dr. Phuong is here, and I hope he's here. I haven't seen him. And he will come up here shortly. Brett Ingram and the ever-present Sena da Silva. You see in the photo here the catfish ponds along the Mekong Delta, the striped catfish on the side. You'll note, as was said in one of the earlier presentations, how so many of these ponds are of similar size. The second case that we're looking at is the Indian shrimp farming community issue, particularly Mr. Bhatt and Umesh are the authors. Umesh is here representing this project. And this one you've heard a little bit about. It involves farmers in the coastal areas in India who had major problems in terms of water management. By getting into clusters, they have very effectively dealt with this, and there's a whole set of social interaction and knowledge sharing activities that we looked at in this case, and I'll only mention it briefly here, but Umesh can talk more about it when we get to the panel. Our third case from Chile, the case by Rodrigo Infante, who will talk more about the story in Chile. Most of us have heard about the problems in Chile, this very rapidly growing industry, and particularly the issue of ISA and this disease story has a very strong knowledge component. And in fact, as we'll show you later on, a major lesson learned in terms of who did or did not share knowledge in various parts of this equation. Our next case, and unfortunately Guzel was unable to join us, is the sea bass case, which is very similar to the sea bass story in neighboring Greece. We heard the presentation by Lara yesterday afternoon about the sea bass in Greece. A very good presentation. So this case looks at that set of issues, and particularly the problem of what Guzel called a lack of tradition. In this particular area, and particularly in the Turkish situation, the history of aquaculture is very limited. There is very little knowledge and tradition on which to base some of this work. And she sees that as an important part of some of this knowledge thinking. And then we have two regional bodies as our fifth and sixth cases. So Courtney is going to, has been involved with us in terms of this Federation of European Aquaculture Producers, and particularly this knowledge platform, the ATIP. And you've heard bits of it in Patrick Sorgalos' presentation. Courtney has pulled together some of this information, and particularly what we're hoping people will take away from some of this is the increasing use of different things like these platforms, like knowledge brokers. There's a variety of tools that seem to be increasingly important in terms of getting knowledge through some of these barriers, etc., that we were mentioning. Finally, the case of NACA, and particularly the program of both their training and extension. You see some of the work Saina mentioned, the farmer-to-farmer interactions and how successful that was, the various other forms of South-South collaboration, specialized training courses. So their case study, which Yuan, who will come up and join us on the stage, looked in detail at some of this training and extension, how they are struggling with trying to keep up with new knowledge and trying to meet the needs of an increasing number of stakeholders at a variety of levels, whether farmers through to researchers. And you see here some of the materials, and Yuan's partner and colleague Simon Wilkinson will be able to tell us more about some of these materials that are being used by NACA in terms of communicating knowledge through their various publications, the journal, newsletters, and particularly the website. And there's, in this case study, a whole set of experiences in terms of the website and how that it might be used and how they are experimenting increasingly with this. For instance, the voice over internet protocol work they're trying out in Indonesia to get farmers more easily sharing knowledge. So, those are our six cases. And as I say, each of these cases is trying we were taking each of them in terms of this common conceptual base and then try to summarize the different lessons learned across the cases. And again, I emphasize this is rough, it's early, etc. What I've had to do is these, in the actual publication, there are tables that go across all the cases. But it became too information dense, and Doris and I struggled with how to say this. So what I've done is for some of the selected issues on the far left-hand side, and then just chosen a few selected cases just to give you glimpses of some of the issues we see starting to come out in this analysis. So, for instance, in the Vietnam catfish case, we see that there's a whole set of knowledge issues around the early history, where they started, where were some of the constraints, etc. And we see that in both the India and Vietnam case, and many other practices here in the Asian region, there has been some kind of traditional system, which has been going on in many cases for 30, 40 or more years. For some reason, and this I think is another one of the issues that we would like to see looked at through some of this, what I would call change process analysis. In the Vietnam case, for instance, it seemed to be triggered by a change in an improved breeding mechanism, but moving to a cage culture production system. And exactly why it happened in Vietnam and why it happened in the late 80s, 90s is, again, one of these conundrums. But there was this phenomenal increase in production of this Pangasius catfish based on a number of different technology and other factors that we've started to look at earlier in the Success Stories book and in some of these cases. Similarly, in the India case that I mentioned earlier, we see that particularly the problems of disease and this crisis was a common stimulus, a starting point that led to fish farmers getting together, working together, and trying to work out common approaches with some of the scientists in terms of good disease management practices. And then the cage culture situation in Chile. Again, another very rapid growing industry. Chile is the second largest producer of salmon. The farmers were very well organized into associations and thought to be well positioned against crises. But then the disease, the ISA problem, hit. And there's a set of issues that we're going to try and look at. So the next issue was, and these are very rough, I repeat, a look at what changed. What are some of the current knowledge management issues? So as I was mentioning, in the Vietnam case, around the year 2000, there was a variety of things that Dr. Phuong and colleagues had looked at, but one particular thing was this breeding technology. And in fact, the ability to breed this fish was a research project with French collaborators working with the Vietnamese in Cantu. And that particular outcome very quickly was then translated into seed supply and followed by new pond culture methods. In the India case, similar kinds of things. Again, the disease story that led to these large numbers of clusters being created, and in fact, an organization, NAXA, to guide these changes and produce a BMP cluster approach. In Chile, the know-how for these salmon farmers was a mixture of foreign, Norwegian, and other groups, as well as Chilean. There was government research, but they still had this very large crisis and the ISA impacts. So there's a whole set of questions around who generates the knowledge, who disseminates the knowledge, who produces it. There's various partnerships between university farmers, government, etc. There may be a set of incentives issues that we need to look at. I won't go into all of the details here. And as I say, the business of who produces, who disseminates, etc., we see this in terms of NACA's interest at a regional level, as well as Courtney's FEEP group in terms of their platforms and, again, regional approaches. In terms of challenges, again, we can see some common threads, and it may be partly artificial in terms of the choice of our cases, but throughout most of our cases, we see a common disease issue, but we also see a social organization issue and a shared knowledge, and going back to some of the connectivism thinking that I mentioned earlier. So they're continuing in most of these cases, and these are ongoing activities, there continue to be major problems still to be dealt with in terms of knowledge and shared learning, and including the researchers trying to better understand some of these issues, looking at some of the traditional practices, etc. I won't go into too many of these details. So, some general lessons learned. As I said, disease and management problems were common, and initially there seems to be poor knowledge sharing. Particularly in the Chile case, we suspect that farms are operating on an independent market-based thinking and are reluctant to share knowledge. And part of the lesson learned here may be that they need, if they're going to be surviving in this kind of competitive market, look more at some of the ecosystem thinking that we heard earlier in Doris and others' presentations, where your drive to be first and in the market strongly positioned needs now more tempering in terms of sharing about disease threats, what kinds of things are happening, and some of that thinking. As I said, the strength in social organization, particularly the India case showing that, and this issue of knowledge platforms and knowledge brokers are starting to show benefits in a number of the regional cases. Okay, so that's a brief summary of some of what we see in our cases, and these are very sketchy initial thinking. What we then tried to do was look at a wider set of issues, and particularly looking at this health science work. And some of you may know that, particularly in Africa, there has been a strong concern of large knowledge body out there in terms of how to deal with some of the major diseases, but actual disease incidence was not going down. There were the problems continued, and there seemed to be this knowledge gap. And so I was particularly attracted to that set of issues and their work in terms of trying to take some of this knowledge thinking into what they called knowledge translation and some of this implementation science. So, coming back to our two initial quotations, we see that in many of our cases that there is knowledge being stored in our partners, but also in competitors and regulators and others. And so we need to look, I think, at a variety of mechanisms as to who needs what knowledge when, and particularly how can we both understand that problem, where are the constraints, etc., and how to deal with some of this. COPs refers to communities of practice. Gary mentioned this. And that increasingly we see the use of these communities of practice as a mechanism to promote some kind of shared learning. And I think there's a whole knowledge base in terms of shared learning from the auto industry, from a variety of other communities of practice, where you get people who share the same problem trying to work together even though they come from different backgrounds to in fact work out some of these issues. Moving to a slightly broader set of challenges and moving into the finishing of my slides. We know aquaculture as a rapidly changing activity, and so I use aquaculture equals change, and it seems as though it's going to continue to be changing. And I think part of our issue, part of our struggle, is one of trying to better understand these change processes. We've looked at some of this in terms of what we call development phases and trying to understand this over often 30 or 40 year time frames. And I think there's a variety of basic issues here that we need to look at, as I mentioned earlier, about, say, stakeholders and are we adequately meeting their needs? And particularly as we move through this Bangkok Declaration thinking, leading to some improved sustainability, this is going to be more and more important. And it's both the management and its monitoring. Knowledge gaps. I didn't go so far as to put this in terms of recommendations, but rather just trying to provoke some thought around issues for the moment, and then we can look at how to structure this into the Phuket consensus kinds of thinking. But in general, the literature in terms of looking at knowledge and how it is being carried out in aquaculture is very limited, I think. There is very little work on traditional knowledge in aquaculture, and in fact, as I say here, very little in social science more generally. Yet we see a lot of these social processes, the clusters, the grouping, etc., the platforms, being increasingly important. Almost there. There's a variety of disparities in terms of collection and sharing. And one almost final point I want to leave you with is this issue that came out in some of the conversation earlier of what I call the knowledge supply versus demand dichotomy. And right now, it seems to me that we have a very knowledge supply-driven system. And I'm urging that we think in terms of, should we revamp this and push it more this way so that it's more demand-driven, i.e. what some of the earlier speakers had said in terms of, you know, knowledge for whom and who are those people? Where are they? And farmers or whomever, we need to better understand what knowledge needs they have, how to reach them. We need to change the incentives. Researchers are promoted based on publications. Maybe we need to rejig that. So, one other thought. I mentioned in terms of the health sciences and my fascination with some of their work. They have a journal called Implementation Science. This is something I think we need in aquaculture, fisheries, or something like that, or at least something like it. We need mechanisms to look at some of our knowledge-sharing processes and to share that kind of thinking from a research point of view. That we should start looking at these things, understanding what are the barriers, what are the needs, and trying to do some matching. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Devi, for an excellent presentation. Ladies and gentlemen, can you join me in applauding our last presenter? I would now like to call upon the panel members to come up. Those that assisted Dr. Devi to put this presentation together, if you could make your way up. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, the floor is now open for questions. Yes?
I promised Brian I'd ask some incomprehensible questions. So here's one, Brian. It's an interesting proposition, this knowledge half-life. I find that interesting. It was the first time I heard about it. I suppose when you raise knowledge to the higher level, which is wisdom, then there would be a very long life. That's one comment. The second comment is your latest arrows, that making knowledge demand-driven, because right now you propose or your contention is that it's supply-driven. I would have thought that anyone who writes anything would know already his audience and what they need. I mean, that's a very basic communications principle. You don't write for the sake of writing and disseminate it, hoping that anybody will catch and benefit from it. Because a good communicator would first know what is his audience, what they need, and then write about or talk to them. Thank you.
Thanks, Pete. Do you want to say something, Simon? Or?
Okay. Yeah, I think this issue was covered a bit in the last presentation, actually. I think it was mentioned that there's a fundamental disconnect between the people who produce knowledge professionally and the people who are supposed to be consuming it. And I agree in principle that people who write things should be thinking about who's going to consume that. But I think one of the problems is that the incentives for a lot of our knowledge producers are not inclined to do that. I mean, scientists get rewarded for writing papers. They get rewarded for research. But I'm not sure they get the incentives are there to reward them for doing development as well. So that's where that gap comes from. And this is nothing new. People have been talking about it for decades, but it seems to be a very persistent problem. And maybe it's something that funding agencies and research institutions need to give a bit of thought to, rewarding your scientists or your other knowledge workers for, beyond research, doing a bit more development or putting some resources into that as well.
Eknath from India. Brian, I'm pretty sure I didn't sleep off. I must have missed something. When I saw the title, Investing in Research, I think that part probably was not touched on very, very much here. I was expecting some sort of what kind of research, for whom, what, when, what. In the last slide which you showed, of course it sort of started to say when supply is too much but there is no demand. But now who should be deciding this? Are you by any chance talking about some kind of priority setting or what kind of research is going to pay off in a short term, long term, medium term? Thank you.
No, there were many choices that we could have made in terms of how to orient this, and it's a very broad topic, the one that was provided as a general guideline. And so we chose to focus more on knowledge and communications, as I said. rather than research per se. But knowledge being a product of research, or at least one of them, it's part of it. But what we wanted to try and do was focus more on this knowledge concept and try and look at the whole system of whether we are in fact meeting the needs of stakeholders in terms of knowledge and come at it from a different way than the traditional research and priority setting, etc. That is there. And that is, you know, been discussed in various fora. What we were trying to do was come at this in a different way, get people thinking differently, and the hope is that in fact more people will look at this and try to follow some kind of more knowledge-based approach.
I think we had one right at the back.
And Estelle Scott from University of Copenhagen. Thanks for a nice presentation. Just a comment based on quite some years of experience working with building up research capacity and doing research also here in Asia. And that is actually, I think we need to meet researchers where they are in terms of how they are promoted. I don't think we'll go very far by trying to change career structures and how university works in terms of putting merit to publication and so. But if we talk communication, for example, at least our experience are also from back home, it's very clear the more visible, the more people and researchers communicate, the more money they get. So it's actually not a contradiction we have. It's very clear the very best researchers we have, for example, at the university, they are also the one that are the most visible. They make popular communications. They appear in television, etc. So it actually goes very well together. And that also goes for the work we do, for example, that relates to aquaculture here. It's very clear that you can work with that, of course, targeting whether it's the extension and so, but it's also strategic communication in terms of getting funding. So it's not that difficult, actually.
Okay. No,
Another comment on the issue of, like you said, Simon, researchers should focus on development. I'm not so sure about that. I think we should be aware where our strengths are. We should do relevant research, action-based research, but we are not the one that has a mandate and should be responsible for development. There's a whole range of other stakeholders that are much better than that. We should deliver and work with them to deliver the research-based evidence to make this happen. But I'm not sure we should take that as a main mandate.
Actually, we discussed quite a bit at the beginning and how to do this, and it was really impossible to do both, focus in the research or in knowledge management. But we did agree on that the amount of information and the diversity of information is increasing. It's enormous, really, if you look at the aquaculture publications. And we realize as well that there is a need of filtering what is really relevant or what can be used. And in that sense, I think it was very important, the point of the knowledge platforms and you know, the farmers' associations.
Maybe just to complement a bit on that, is that in fact, well, in Chile, in relation to the research development and in order to develop knowledge to the things that were critical for us, it was created in 1995, the INTESAL, the Technological Institute for Salmon, precisely on the idea of trying to orientate the academia or the universities in relation to what were the topics that were more relevant for us. Now, when you have knowledge created through that way, I think it's very difficult not to have a certain, like, a reactive action in relation to the point, the themes or the topics that are more burning for the producers, them are the ones that are the topics that being understood or being investigated more. And as that, I think that Chile had a very good knowledge and treatment of all bacterial diseases, but when touching on the issue of the ISA virus case, when a virus gets into the country, that it's a whole new ball game, and that's why changes have been done now in all the system in order to be able to achieve those kind of problems, but the idea is to have the structures that are able to be responding and guiding in a certain way the research in the orientation that the producer wants. That marriage between the creation of knowledge and the people that are doing all the investigations is not a thing that's very easily done, and I agree very much with where the incentives are for the people of the universities, which are different from the incentives or the needs that most of the time the producers have.
I think we had an end from Alessandro.
Yes, Alessandro Lovatelli from FEO Rome. My question is a bit different. There is a lot of information, knowledge, which is developed all over, across the globe, be it technical, be it on marketing, be it on business, and so on and so forth. But for the aquaculture industry to be sustainable, we need to have proper regulation, policies in support of the industry. Now, those regulations and policy are prepared by non-biologists, by people that don't really understand the aquaculture sector. Possibly they don't understand, you know, the biological part of it, the marketing part of it, the business part of it. So my question to the panel is the following. Are we doing enough to translate the information which is generated to enable the policymakers to understand it so that they can generate the right regulations or the right incentive to further promote the industry? Thank you.
I think it obviously depends on where you are. Now, from my own experience within Europe, we do actually have official consultation between the aquaculture profession and the Commission, and now particularly since the Lisbon Treaty with the European Parliament. So there are increasing opportunities for, shall we say, professions and linked stakeholders to the sector to be able to discuss those issues. Obviously, this takes a very long time. And just as an example, both two major pieces of legislation which affect European aquaculture would be the aspects of the Common Fisheries Policy that links to how aquaculture can develop, and also the Common Organization of the Markets, which influences how aquaculture products are treated within the common market, as it were. And it's, in fact, I think, quite clear that recognition that that is actually providing both the Parliament and the European Commission with a direct line into what is actually going on. That means that policies are beginning to reflect quite accurately what we require within the system to be sustainable. Now, this is further complicated, obviously, by different aspects on the environment, on public health, which all have their own different DGs and different mandates. And all of this is now coming slowly together, and it's actually one of the driving forces for having the technology platform, because the technology platform is based on having even wider inputs from a multi-stakeholder base so that we can actually recognize or try to discuss, recognize short-term, medium-term, long-term problems, identify those as issues that need to be resolved, and then generate the research and support mechanisms that are required to resolve that. I would also say one of the big changes over the last 10 years is really now that we're having these meetings in one language, in English, whereas 15 years ago, 20 years ago, it was actually extremely difficult to arrange that because not everybody spoke English, not every farmer spoke. You know, you're from Italy, not every Italian farmer speaks English. So actually getting genuine debate within a genuine cost-effective debate that was going to be productive was actually very, very difficult. And that's one of the major things that has changed enormously, enabling, frankly, the FIAP itself, which is a federation of 22 different countries, to become much stronger, very simply because we all speak the same language. We can't afford translation into 22 different languages.
Thank you for the presentation. I'm Johan from Fish Protect. We're a technology-based company, and we license our technology, and as part of that, of course, we train the people that use our technology, and we provide knowledge. So, in fact, we became also a demander of knowledge so that we could improve the operation. So we work closely with R&D projects, with universities and organizations in the different countries. And having that facility of actually talking to all your farmers through either a newsletter, we also have a better way of transferring that knowledge to our farmers. So that's the good part of it. However, what we found that is most of our problems in the farms are not due to lack of knowledge. They're mainly due to lack of skill. Most farmers suffer losses because someone makes a mistake or doesn't know how to do it. And where I see a problem in the overall learning process is on the vocational level. I think that we have a lot of very good scientists and very good researchers, but what the farmer actually needs is people that know how to do the farming. And that's to do with skills. Now, traditionally, that would come from father to son. Farmer was a family business, so you have these apprentices that work there. Nowadays, in large farming, people expect to be knowing how to grade fish, how to handle fish, how to feed fish. And that is a problem that I still see. So actually, the skill is, to me, more important at the farm phase level. Knowledge, we're able to do that, and we're able to, and it is important, of course, but we're lacking that. And I would like to ask the panel to see what is the possibility of actually improving the skill levels and having that as a target. Thank you.
John, do you want to talk a little bit about NACA and training?
Yeah, I fully agree with you. This is a problem because, as we all know from scientists, so when we write the proposal, normally we start with a research project, so we do have some kind of requirement. You need to have some kind of information dissemination strategies or extension strategies, but all these proposals are written by scientists. So frequently when we conduct trainings, so the things often we notice is when we invite some real very good scientists and experts and then come, and often their perception for the training, like session delivery, they think it's like give a lecture or pretty much like in classroom sessions. So this is it's a reality. I guess we really need some hard effort and long way to try to let bridge the scientists and the farmers together. In the middle, I guess we really need to put some effort to cultivate some real training professionals or extension professionals. They really know how to pass this knowledge and make it become the skills which farmers really need. So this, I guess we really need to pay more attention on this side, yeah.
And just a little advertising, there's a brochure, there are some up here, and there's on the table outside the room on the NACA table that lists the different kinds of training and education programs that are offered here through NACA in the region, including study tours and various other kinds of things that are, I think, partially filling some of this need that you're mentioning. That was a little advertisement. I hope you don't mind.
Any more questions from the floor? You first, and then you, please.
Thank you. Well, it's becoming more and more clear to us all that it is a holistic approach that brings scientists, decision makers, final beneficiaries all together in one spot who can all together plan integratedly for the development of the sector. And of course, there are intermediate links. There are extension officers and people who are transforming the sophisticated knowledge into simple, practical way to be furnished to the fish farmers. So I believe that collaboration between all these categories of people will bring up something that is good for the whole sector. Thank you.
The comments from the panel?
I guess when we really try to bring the knowledge to the farmers, it's really a complex process. We need to simplify the knowledge or make it really applicable. So very good examples are, so we did is we try to, let's say, for kind of training for the management, business management principle, bring this kind of principle to the farm at farm level. So the process for preparation is really long. Sometimes you bring the economists to come in. So the effort is usually take quite long time. So you need all the people sit together before this training really can be conducted. So there quite some investment on this. Like training, the resources actually for training for this kind of effort is very, very limited. So this is the one side. In the future, probably some government or funding agencies, you should think about this. Yeah.
Okay, we had one question here. Yes.
Yogi Carolsfeld. Sorry about expulsion. I've been doing, or we've been doing, these community exchanges that were mentioned for some time, as well as the sort of a mixed group technical trips, which I think, you know, we've also found to be very effective. But I think, you know, they point out some of the issues of, you know, what I think are the processes behind this knowledge transfer that we're talking about. Specifically, you know, we've been doing this primarily with Brazilian groups over the last 20 years, and there's been changes. But I think some of the things that really come out are that, you know, I find that, you know, trust is a key element to knowledge transfer. And so, of course, we try and peer-to-peer learning is a very, very interesting way to address that question. The other one is, of course, to put these people that don't trust each other together in a van and run them over a gravel road or something, and at the end of the day, they trust each other in a certain fashion, and then, of course, the knowledge sharing starts getting much better. The other thing is transparency. So I think it's linked a little bit. But, you know, we find that there are knowledge brokers and knowledge middlemen and people that, you know, bottlenecks through people. And, you know, you address this question to a certain extent. I think, you know, that abundance of knowledge versus small amount of demand is quite good in that sense, that, you know, you feel that there's an abundance of knowledge that we can all tap into. You start restricting that too much, then you have maybe create this sort of middleman approach, which is negative in terms of that knowledge transfer. We also find that you know, through these trips, we develop the capacity. It's a linked question, I guess, the capacity for knowledge mining, so you can actually deal with all that knowledge. Of course, at the end of the day, you create then these knowledge champions, which are your development champions. I'm not sure if one could maybe, you guys could comment if those are similar sort of things that you are finding in this process.
We're running out of time. We have 1 minute and the panel can respond.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. So the first thing in extension is we need to gain the farmer's trust. So without the trust, so they're not going to even listen to us. So what we did is we did a scientific study to understand what was their requirement, you know, what were their problems, and based on that, so some of the risk factors were identified and the solutions were developed for that. And even once we develop the solutions, so that's the first step. And again, to convey that in the farmer language and communicate in such a way that the complex science to in a farmer level to make them understand. And that's the second step. Again, then we have to implement it and show its impact. So when we do all these three and during the process, when we gain the farmer trust and he understands the science and he really benefits from that demonstration. So then only, you know, so they're going to implement it and then they will be talking to each other and that's how this message gets conveyed to more and more farmers.
We're running out of time. We'll have the last question from Dr. Silva.
That's why I didn't want to sit on the panel because I want to ask you questions. We are all talking of a top-down approach here. Almost all of it. What I'm more interested is there is farmer innovation, single farmers innovating new things. And to me, communicating that farmer innovations to the other farmers is equally important or more important than the top-down approach. It's only last week, I think Albert referred to this meeting we had in Manila on feed management. for the first time ever, I think, for a FAO expert consultation, I think I twisted the arm of the FAO officer and we took a farmer because he had an innovation, a very simple thing, but he saved $24,000 per crop. And that's the message I would like to get the other catfish farmers in a very competitive environment to adopt. A very simple thing. And that's something that we haven't considered. And I would like this panel to make a recommendation. There needs to be some mechanisms developed to disseminate or carry forward farmer innovation. I'm not talking of indigenous knowledge. I'm talking of farmer innovations.
Okay, can you make it quick? We are running. We've gone over time.
I agree absolutely. Approach. I think that the importance of what happens in a farm and how that information is shared in between different producers, I think it's very important. And the point of trust, obviously, in between the farmers, it's critical in order to be able to be effective in that. And in Chile, the changes that now is happening in relation to this have this area management. That means that it's not only one farm, the one that can do in its farm whatever they want, but they have to coordinate between different farms, really activates and benefits that kind of processes, because then, obviously, information between different farms have to be opened, because that, obviously, what happens in my farm, in one farm, it's critical to what happens on the other, though, so that relation of neighborship begins to be much more present and much more real. So I think that kind of things are things that will spur and would activate that kind of possibilities, and then through that have what are our common problems, and as that search for the solutions, et cetera, or share the things that have been learned.
Okay, thank you very much. We're running out of time. On behalf of the organizers, I'd like to thank Dr. Devi and the panel for a wonderful presentation. If you can join with me in applauding them for this wonderful presentation, please.